I pray that you would be here in our midst, that you would teach us, that you would guide us, and that we would walk away from here knowing you better. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, we're on Elijah's ministry among the people, and we've already been meeting the prophets. We saw that Elijah was the fiery prophet. He stood alone before kings, and he declared it was Yahweh, not Baal, and he proved over and over again that it was God and not the Baals. But the kings pretty much didn't heed his warning, did they? Elisha, his successor, now has a more quiet ministry. And it's interesting because if you think back in time to when Israel was just about ready to enter the promised land, they had come with Moses, they were in the wilderness, God had promised them the land, they had just come out of captivity, and Moses had said, if you don't follow God's covenant, this land is not a guarantee. You will end up right where you started, back in captivity. The kings continue to break God's covenant, the prophets continue to warn them, and yet they continue to go unheeded, and where we're heading is exactly back where they came from, back into captivity. So the ministry of Elisha now is a change. As we've seen, the kings continue to go further and further away from the Lord, and so Elisha now, his ministry is more to the faithful people. Remember, Elijah said, I'm the only one, and God said, no, there's 7,000. We're starting to see them. And what's fun about going through the stories of Elisha is we actually get to get a peek into society in that day. And the time we're talking about is 850 to 800 BC. So we're going to learn a lot about family life. Most of these stories, we have to understand the biblical background or the cultural background before we get into the story. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to share with you the background, and then the story should make a little more sense to us. So today we had four stories. The first two had to do with women. Did you find that interesting? One was a poor widow woman, the other one was a wealthy woman. But I want you to notice how much of the Bible is given to women. God has always cared for and regarded women. We tend to think in the Old Testament that the women weren't of importance, but notice how much of the Bible is given to the story of the women. So in God's view, they were very important. The first story is the widow and her oil, and it's important for us to understand the debt structure and enslavement in order to understand the story. At that time, the common person didn't have money. Everything was done with commodities. I will exchange what I have for what I need. If you think back to the story last week, the king of Moab revolted because he didn't want to pay his tribute. What was his tribute? Sheep and wool. Because he did what? He bred sheep. So he didn't pay money, but he paid in sheep. In the situation that this woman's in, she had a debt, and her husband died, and she was unable to pay that debt. Now, the other way that you could pay off a debt was that you could sell yourself into slavery, or we would say to hire yourself out. And this was a common practice. Now, God does not condone this practice, but he knew it was going to happen. And so what he did was made a provision for it in his laws. In fact, in Deuteronomy 21:2, we read, if you buy a Hebrew slave, he's to serve for only 6 years. In the seventh year, you're to set him free, and he will owe you nothing. So God knew that when they became indebted, they would tend to sell themselves, or the creditors would come and take them and force them to do labor to pay for what they owed. But it couldn't go on indefinitely. Only 6 years. In the seventh year, the debt was paid off no matter what. So with that little bit of information, we also go to outside information. I've really gotten into the Hebrew culture because I found out that they know a lot about their own story. And they have a lot of background history that we don't necessarily pick up. So I found two historical bits of information that will help. The first comes from the Targum, which is the Jewish translation of the Hebrew Bible. Interesting. The Bible, almost all of it was written in Hebrew originally. Very few, even the Gospels, weren't all in Greek. The Greek was the common language that it was translated into. They tell us who this prophet was. His name was Obadiah. Does that start to ring a bell? Obadiah. Remember the story of Ahab? He had a faithful servant named Obadiah. When Jezebel was trying to kill off all the prophets of God, what was Obadiah doing? He was hiding them and he was feeding them, wasn't he? Well, according to Josephus, the first century historian, the reason Obadiah was in debt was in order to pay for the prophets that he kept in hiding. So that may or may not be true, but whether it's not, it still helps us understand the story a little bit better. So that brings us now to our story. It begins with this woman who has now become a widow. She has two sons. We can't tell the age from the Hebrew word. The word that they use means a small boy to a young man, but it's pretty well assumed that they were small. They weren't men. They weren't young men at this point. They were probably young boys. And she comes to Elisha and asks for help because she says her husband has died and her creditors are coming to enslave her sons, take her sons to work for them to pay the father's debts. And she reminds Elisha that he was a faithful servant of the Lord. And Elisha says that he would like to help. And notice what he says. He says, "What do you currently have available?" And she says, "Well, I don't have very much. I only have a small pot, jar, flask of oil," whatever your translation says. And the Lord tells him, "That's enough." Now, for you and I, we're thinking a jar, maybe a Wesson oil size. Actually, what she's talking about is that her husband had a small vial of olive oil that he used to anoint people with. We're talking about a little, maybe a half a cup at the most. And Elisha says, "Well, go to all your neighbors and ask for all the empty jars, not just a few. Get as much as you can. Then bring them home, go into your house, shut your door, you and your sons." She does this, and then he tells her to start pouring the oil. That expresses her faith. As long as she keeps pouring, the oil keeps flowing. I thought that was interesting. She has a small vial, something we could just hold in our hand, and keeps pouring, and keeps pouring, and keeps pouring, and it fills every jar that they have, and she says, "Bring more," and her sons finally say, "That's it." She also was told to go in and shut the door. That was interesting. You talked about it in your discussion groups today. I don't know what answers you came up with. I'm sure you came up with "the boys were a witness," or I love the way Ildiko put it yesterday. She didn't want it to get on the front page of the news. All the different reasons. But there's another reason we might not pick up. Does this story seem familiar? Remember the story of Elijah and the woman whose oil jar never went empty? The difference between the story of Elijah and Elisha is that in the story of Elijah, the prophet was there. In the story of Elisha, who is in the room? The woman, her sons, and of course we know God. But there is no prophet there. The lesson that's being taught is even though she doesn't have a husband who is faithful to provide for her because he's not there, she doesn't need a prophet. Who does she have? She has God, and God is faithful. God will meet her needs. And he was teaching not only the woman but her sons that they could depend upon God in that story. Well, the second story is about a Shunammite woman. This is an entirely different story. We have a well-to-do woman. Now, well-to-do has to do with wealth, but even more. Well-to-do means that she was, in her own right, recognized in the community. When we get into the New Testament, we notice a lot of women, and they have various things they're known for. She was well-to-do in that she was an important woman in her own right, separate from her husband, as well as the fact that she did have wealth. The background that we need to know in this story is hospitality. Hospitality was not just good manners. It was actually moral obligation. When you traveled from here to there, there were no hotels. Hospitality began way before Abraham. If you think about it, you're going across the desert. It was critical that you be able to get out of the heat and have water. And even today, you can stop at any Bedouin tent, and they will take you in, and everything stops for you. And that's the way it was. And the way it worked in this particular time in 850 BC is if you were traveling through the city, you would go to the water source, whether it's the spring or whether it's the well, and you would sit down, and everybody knew everybody, and they would recognize you as a visitor in need of something, and you wouldn't be invited in. You could also go to the city gate, or if it was a large city, to the town square. But anywhere you went, you would just sit and wait, and somebody would come and invite you in. And it's really interesting because they would invite you in, and they would feed you, they would give you water, they would give you food for you and your animals, and they would give you lodging. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a minute because it's important that we also understand what their houses look like. For the Israelites, they began in tents, and then they went to two-room houses, but by now it's been well documented they're in a four-room house. But they're not like any houses you and I would think of. This is what their typical house looked like. It's basically a rectangle with walls around it, and you go in through the front door, which is essentially a wooden gate, and it's like our gates today. It swings open and shut on poles. And as you go in there, to the right, pillars and gravel or rock, that's your kitchen. To the left is the same pillars with a rock, that's your workroom. Incidentally, your animals live there too. And then in the back, this actually is a very wealthy home because we see it has 6 rooms. Those 4 rooms back there, in this case, you would have 3 storerooms and a sleeping room. 1 sleeping room. Everybody sleeps together. If you are a guest, you are invited to sleep with the family. Now, quite often, it includes sleeping in the same bed. And it is good manners to have your guest sleep with you. It is bad manners to have your guest sleep someplace else. And the animals are also brought into the courtyard. Everybody's all inside there. Now, this is what it looked like in 850 B.C. The pictures that I have are from Jesus' day, but I want to show them to you because it explains to us a little bit about a wealthy family. And this, mind you, is 900 years later. This is probably what Elijah's room looked like because most of those homes had no furniture. Only the very wealthy had furniture. Elijah had a bed. A bed means he had a wooden frame. He would roll out his mat on a wooden frame. Chances are they wouldn't have a blanket. They would have some sort of mat that they rolled out, and then they slept with their coat. That became their blanket. So that's probably what his room looked like. But look at 900 years later, they still, look at the floors, they're wooden. This one has the sleeping quarters on the second story. Elisha also had a table and chairs. This is a two-story structure. Most of them in their day only had the first floor. Culturally, that helps us understand what it looked like. So our story begins with that bit of background that Elisha, who we already know, is traveling. He probably lives mainly in Gilgal, and he travels Jericho, Bethel, Gilgal, Samaria, and up to Mount Carmel. But when he goes this way, it's really easy just to go right through Shunem. And after doing this several times, this wealthy woman says to her husband, Elisha's a man of God. And we have the means, let's prepare a room for him so he doesn't have to sit by the well every time he comes by and waits for somebody to notice. Let's just provide for him a room. And so they do that, and in that is the bed, the table, the chair, and a lamp. It's an open saucer with a pinched nose that you would pour olive oil and a little wick in, and it doesn't give very much light at all. But this would have been like the Ritz-Carlton, because normally everybody would be in the same room. But he was free to come and go. And apparently he was the only one that used this, and it was called a prophet's chamber later, just simply because prophets came and went and used this. As you saw today, it was about 20 miles from Shunem up to Mount Carmel. So that was a good day's walk or a good ride. So that was a logical place for her to stop. Well, the story begins that Elisha is resting very comfortably on his bed, thinking, this is just wonderful that I've been provided this. What can I do to honor this woman? So she has Gehazi, his servant, go and call the woman. She comes, notice she stands in the door. She doesn't enter. And he says, what can I do for you? Do you have a tax issue? Can I go to the king? Or do you have a property issue or protection issue? I can go to the commander of the army. And she says, no, I have everything I need. I don't need a thing. And she leaves. Well, Elisha's not satisfied, so he asks his servant Gehazi, can you think of anything? And he says, well, she doesn't have a son and her husband's old. Indicating what? That she wouldn't have any provisions. His name won't be carried on. So Elisha says, call her back up. She comes back up and he says, about this time next year, you're going to hold a son in your arms. Do you notice her response? Oh, man of God, don't lie to me. You think he touched a very sensitive spot? I think so. I'm sure this is an issue she had dealt with. She was able to cope, and the fact that he would even dare bring up that deep need in her life, she didn't even want to hear of the possibility unless it was so. But as we saw, 1 year later, there she was with that son in her arms. The story begins that he grows up a little bit, and he's old enough to go out into the field. His dad's out there harvesting, and when he gets out there, he complains of a headache. And so he's taken back, and he's small enough yet that he can crawl up in his mother's lap. And at noon, he dies. Now, we don't know what he died of, but it was very common for sunstroke. It's very hot. It can get up to 120 degrees there, and if you don't have enough water, it doesn't take long. And so it could have been this. It could have been anything else. It doesn't matter. But notice what she does. She shuts the door. She lays him on Elisha's bed and shuts the door. Now, where is he? He's on the roof in a place that nobody would necessarily go. And she sends word to her husband asking for the donkey so that she can quickly travel to Elisha and back. This would be a little like us having one car in the family and asking, can we use the car? Because what is the husband doing? He's out in the field with the reapers. Chances are he's using the donkey in order to do the harvesting. Don't know. But she asked permission to do this. And he goes, why do you want to go see Elisha? It's not Sunday. It's not Easter. It's not Christmas. It's not a normal day that you would go and worship. And she says, no, it's okay. I just need to go see him quickly. She didn't give him any indication that was anything wrong. Did you find that interesting? I did too, but let's go back to the culture. There's a death in the family. What's the immediate response? You have to go into mourning. I mean, you don't have to. You automatically go into mourning. And we haven't talked about it, but with a burial, there's a 3-day mourning period with the body so that they make sure that they're really dead before they bury him. And in this case, what would 3 days do? It would delay her. So she says nothing. She doesn't want anything to delay her. She has to get to Elisha. Notice her faith at this point. It is not the same faith it was before she had the son. Her faith is strong. She says, if I can get to Elisha, everything will be all right. But notice what she says to her servant. She says, verse 24, lead on. Don't slow down for me unless I tell you. In other words, hurry, we have to get them. So they go, and as they arrive near Mount Carmel, again, this is on the high point. You can see for a long distance. As she's coming, Elisha recognizes her and says to Gehazi, that's the Shunammite woman. Run down there and see what's going on. I love that. If it had been Elijah, he would have been running up and down. Remember, he was always running up and down. Not Elisha. He always sends Gehazi, you know, you go run down there. So he runs down there and he meets her and he says, is everything okay? And what does she say? Everything's all right. No delays. I've got my focus on Elisha. When she gets to him, how she greets him is another culturally appropriate way for someone deeply honored. Remember, this is a Near Eastern culture. What she does is she bows very low, in fact, so low that she touches the ground. And in this case, she grabs a hold of his feet. Gehazi doesn't like this, and so he tries to push her away. And Elisha says, no, don't do that. He says, she's in deep distress, but God hasn't told me why. I found that very interesting because it indicates to us that Elisha had a regular conversation going on with God, and he knew his voice. And he says, I know something's wrong, but God hasn't told me yet what it is. And so what does she say? She says, I didn't ask you for this son. I didn't want this opened up. And yet, here it is. She doesn't say that he's dead, but Elisha now understands completely. So what does he say? Gehazi, gird up your loins, pull your skirt up, tuck it in your pants, and run like the wind back down to her house and take my staff, which is interesting because that's the symbol of his authority as opposed to his cloak, which is the symbol of his position. And he says, I want you to go lay it on the boy's face. And don't stop to talk with anybody along the way. So Gehazi gets down. He starts running the 20 miles. Notice what the woman says. She's not going to go with Gehazi. She says, as surely as Yahweh lives and you live, I will not leave you. Does that sound familiar to you? What did Elisha say to Elijah every time he told him to stay here? As surely as the Lord lives and you live, I'm not going to. So Elisha knew she wasn't going to do anything less than go with him. So the two of them go down there, and of course we know Gehazi lays it on the face and nothing happens. When Elisha arrives, he goes in and shuts the door, and it's just the two of them. And what's the first thing he does? Talks to the Lord. He prays. And I think that's a real good lesson for us. When we have a problem or a concern, the first thing we need to do is take it to the Lord. I don't know what he says. It doesn't tell us, but we know what Elijah said in that same position. He asked God to return the life of the child back to him. Elisha does exactly what Elijah does. He lays on him, basically mirroring his body, hand to hand, face to face, leg to leg. And he breathes life, his life, and we see the child's body gets warm. He gets up, starts walking back and forth, but the child doesn't rise up. So he does it a second time, and then he sneezes 7 times and opens his eyes, and he presents the son a second time to his mother. And again, she bows in respect for who he is. What a miracle. She got 2 miracles. This woman who didn't think she needed anything, thought she had everything, but was faithful to God's servant and received a double blessing. Both the son and her son came back. So often, people say I don't like to study the Old Testament because it's the God of wrath and the God of judgment and he's so harsh. I want us to stop here just a moment. We've been studying this God. He is a God of judgment. But as we've seen, it is with extreme patience and it is not unfounded. But he's also a loving, caring God, just like he is in the New Testament. look at the widow, and look at this woman. Both of them tenderly cared for and loved by God. So I just want us to keep that in focus as we go through these stories. There's a lot of wonderful, loving acts in here. And when people say he's just the God of wrath, well, what about the Shunammite woman? What about the woman? Or what about the woman in Zarephath? God is the same loving God in the Old Testament as he is in the New. The third story has to do with the deadly stew. I thought that was interesting. The last two stories had to do with food. Again, this was a teaching setting. This was with a school of prophets. These were a group of men who were gathering together to study God's word in a pagan land. What's the official religion of Israel at this point? Baal worship, because that's what Ahab had brought in. But God has kept a faithful remnant, and those are the ones now that Elisha is turning his energy to in order to train and encourage, because when they go into captivity, they will be dependent upon what these people know and their relationship with the Lord. So at this point, he's actually teaching them. He's at Gilgal. It tells us it's a famine, and because this isn't in chronological order, it's probably the seven-year famine we're going to read about in chapter 8. And he turns to his servant, who we know is Gehazi, and he says, you know, it's time to eat. Go prepare a big pot of stew. Now, how easy is that in a famine? Not too easy. So probably put out a pot of water, and whoever had KP duty was sent out, try to scrounge something up anywhere they could find it. And they were in great luck this day. They found some herbs, and there was a wild gourd. It's believed it was a wild cucumber, well-known, well-recognized in that day, very fragrant. But whoever had KP had no knowledge of the local flora, because it was known even in that day as deadly. But they chopped it up, threw it in the stew, and everybody sat down to eat. But one bite, they all knew, there's death in the pot. It is bitter, though it smells wonderful. Notice how Elisha deals with it. He takes a handful of flour and throws it in, and it's edible. Now, does flour cure poison? No, it doesn't. It was a symbolic act, teaching these prophets that God can deal with even those things that are evil. And it was also teaching them that God provides for them, for the faithful, even during times of famine. Don't limit God. He can do anything. He can do the impossible. He can take flour and cure poison and make it edible because you need it. And that's all there is. Again, a lesson of God's faithfulness and provision. And the last one was feeding of the multitudes. Now, I want you to see some of these stories are starting to sound familiar to you. And they're also the foundation for what Jesus does in the New Testament. Sometimes I can hardly wait till we get there, but we've got to wait. But we are building the foundation. See how important understanding the Old Testament is. Well, in this case, a man comes with his first fruits. He has a barley harvest. First fruits are offered to the Lord and is usually given to the priests and the Levites. But he lives where? In Israel. Who are the priests and the Levites of Israel? They're non-existent because they've all fled down to Judah, who is still following the Lord, and what we have is Baal worship. So he, in his desire to serve the Lord, presents it to Elisha and the prophets. And Elisha recognizes this as a gift from the Lord and as a provision. So he tells his servant, who is Gehazi, go ahead and feed the men. He goes, what? Look at you got 20 little tiny loaves here, and you've got at least 100 men. How can I possibly do that? What does Elisha say? The Lord has already told me, he's already heard the voice of the Lord, that there will be plenty of food and there will even be enough left over. And the men eat, and sure enough, there's plenty to eat and there is left over, just as God said. Incidentally, the word 100 here is meha, and it can mean 100 or any multiplication of 100. So it may have been 100 or it may have been 100 times something. It's hard to tell in the Hebrew. But the point is the same, that there is plenty. Well, each of those stories today showed that Elisha was chosen by God and that through him God was able to perform miracles for ordinary people. Each of these miracles, though, met needs in individual lives of people who were faithful. The application is directly to these people, but I want us to think about who was Kings written to? The people who were in exile. Imagine, they're already back in slavery. Imagine if you're reading the story about this poor woman who's in debt and her sons are going to be enslaved, and God provides for her. And he does so without a prophet and without a king. Can you take comfort in that if you're in exile, saying God is still there? It depended upon in each one of their case, their faith in God. What about us? Do we still have the same God that Elijah and Elisha had? Is he still able to do miracles? Hebrews 13 says it best, beginning with verse 6. We can say this with confidence. The Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. And then he goes on. Remember your leaders who spoke the word of God to you. Remember Elijah. Remember Elisha. Consider the outcome of the way of their lives and imitate their faith. The Bible, all of the Bible, is given to teach us, to learn from what was the difference in receiving God's miracles in each one of these cases. It was faith. And the rest of the verse says, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Do you know the God of the New Testament is the exact same God of the Old Testament? He has never changed. He is still there and available for us. His power is limited only by the faith of those who believe. So I would challenge you today, how's your faith? Good lesson. Powerful lesson. Look at these stories and take encouragement from them, because see how God cares about the individual and the needs. He cares about what they're going to eat in the famine. He cares about the debt. He cares about the need of a son. God knew about every single person and every single need, and he was there to meet it. They just had to have the faith to believe. Lord, we just come before you with thanks and praise, because you are the same, and we thank you that you care about us as much as you cared about this widow, the woman of Shunem, and the woman of Zarephath. Lord, I pray that you would strengthen our faith as we read these stories. And as we saw with the woman of Shunem, even though her faith wasn't strong at first, as she got to know you and see you work in her life, her faith became unshakable, and she believed you for the impossible. And I pray for each one of us that as we continue to see your hand in our lives, that our faith will become strong and unshakable. May we be the example of the lives, the people around us, that you are the one true God. And we thank you and praise your holy name.